Hey folks, thanks for tuning in to the Get Balanced podcast with me, your host, Dr. Donnie. And today I have such of a special guest. I am talking with Dr. Lori Moore Merrill, the U.S. Fire Administrator. I'm telling you, you are going to receive a lot of knowledge. You're going to feel inspired, and you're also going to get to know her on a more personal level. This is episode 114.
Welcome to the Get Balanced podcast with Dr. Donnie. If you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or emergency medical professional who would like to improve your family relationships, your physical and mental health, and want to have success at work and at home, well, this show is for you. Welcome to the Get Balanced program. Let's get started.
All right, folks, it's with a great honor that I welcome Dr. Lori Moore Merrill, U.S. Fire Administrator. Welcome to the show, Lori.
Good morning and welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. It's quite an honor, and I'm glad the schedule's lined up with you and your staff, and I know you are swamped since you've been on this. Well, you've always been busy, I'm sure, probably. But if you could give the listeners, you know, I know you spent, you know, the huge bulk of your career with, you know, part of the executive staff of the IAFF. But if you could give a little rundown, because I believe you started, if I have this correct, as a medic in Memphis.
I did. Yeah. So I went on the job back in 1987, actually, as a fire department paramedic in Memphis, Tennessee, Memphis Fire Department. And yeah, that was interesting times back then. A lot has changed, thankfully, right? Along the way. And I was recruited to the IFF in 1993. So I did about 7 years in Memphis, went to the IFF, the EMS specialist. So that was at a time when we were really dealing with a lot of new innovations in EMS, not the least of which was a lot of private ambulance companies that were coming on scene and going on the, you know, stock exchanges. So we knew they were going to blow up and grow. And there was a lot of fear at that time about taking firefighter jobs and paramedic jobs. And so I was, again, recruited to the IFF to deal with some of that and create resources for fire-based EMS. And so worked with a lot of folks over the years, Gary Ludwig and John Sinclair and others in that space along the way, just to create a lot of resources and really begin the research of, you know, telling the story of fire-based EMS and why we see the system concept, you know, growing. Then my time at the IFF, I was there for 26 and a half years and really began to lead the whole of the research, looking at fire department operations and really, you know, system type issues like crew size, you know, staffing, effective response force arrivals, all of the things because like that, because things are, the system really is a science-based system. And when we deal with fire dynamics and different structures and hazard levels and the risks that are associated with those hazards, then there is a science behind it. And so trying to bring that out was something that I had the opportunity to do. And then I retired from the IAFF in 2019, just before COVID, thank goodness, and was able to stand up an International Data Institute and really begin to look at data solutions for local fire departments. You know, we've been very frustrated, we being the fire service, very frustrated for years about not being able to use our data effectively for decision-making and making informed presentation to decision-makers locally. And so really trying to do something in that space. And then in October of last year, President Biden asked me to be the fire administrator for his administration. And so here we are.
Was that like, was that like just a phone call popped up?
It was a little more in depth than that. A lot of background checks and it was an interesting road, an interesting path to get to that, you know, swearing in point. But here we are. So just starting my 6 month on the job, and it's been an interesting 6 months.
Oh, yes. Well, huge congratulations on that. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Very honored.
So I want to ask you a little bit, because I'm going to bounce back and forth a couple of things. But when we talk about sort of, well, let me give the listeners a good overview. This is the Get Balanced podcast, right? So it's, for me, it's all about work-life balance. And a lot of times people, you know, they'll say work-life balance, there's no such thing as that anymore and things like that. And I'm like, well, call it what you will, you know, whatever name you want to put on it, I don't really care. But it's really about, for me, in my research, it's been about, I define it in a question. And I just ask people, I say, are your daily behaviors in alignment with your priorities in life? And I usually let that sink in with people a little bit. Are my daily behaviors in alignment with my priorities in life? And when I do the workshops around the country, Lori, most people are thinking, wait a minute, I never thought about my priorities in a long time. What are those priorities, you know? And because we get caught up, whether we're in the fire service, whether we're in law enforcement, or whether we're in business, doesn't matter what we do, we get caught up running pretty hard. We, meaning, you know, generally Americans, right? We get caught up running pretty hard. So what I sought to do, because my PhD was just a few years ago, was, and it took me several different committee chairs to, because I kept having them turn me down, as in, you can't do that research. It's too complicated. You know, I got that, wait till after you get your PhD, then you can research what you want to research, right? You know, just do the simple thing up front. And I was like, no, I don't want to do it that way. I want to research this. So what I did is I went five different industries, five different case studies, and I wanted to find people that were very effective in their careers, very effective and happy with their families, and took great care of themselves, their health, right? And figure out, so I wanted to study what was right to find out, hey, are there any, you know, common themes in this? And what came out of it, the biggest common theme, they put their self-care as top priority. And when I mean self-care, I'm talking their physical care, their mental health, their social care, and their spiritual care, those four quadrants, right? Physical, mental, social, and spiritual. And they put those first, as in when they talked about their priorities, they talked about intentionally planning, like getting it on their calendar. When they travel, how are they going to exercise? How are they going to eat right? Okay, they're going to a convention. People are want to go out drinking. Okay, how do I, you know, all those, they mastered the ability to put their self-care first. And then what they ended up saying was, hey, being effective in my career and with my family just sort of fell in place because I took care of myself, and I had, and they talked so much about the positive spillover effect of, you know, like when I exercise, I'm now more calm and creative and emotionally stable and all of that. So when I talk about work-life balance and I ask people, hey, you know, are your daily behaviors in alignment with your priorities in life? I follow it up by saying, I'm not here to tell you what your priorities ought to be, but I'll tell you what others have said, like 99%, right? Health and wellness and family relationships, you know? So I want to get your thoughts on feelings, if you will. When we talk about wellness or well-being, or, you know, whatever term we want to use on that, how would you describe the current reality of the fire service today? Not necessarily where it's been, but where it's today when it comes, because, you know, it's a big topic, the whole health and wellness piece, obviously.
Yeah, wow, that's a great question. I think it's hard to know where we are without having seen where we've been, first of all. So the fire service has been, and I think this is very generationally driven, Donnie, and I know you and I have talked about this before, has had some you know, generational inputs, because we have to understand the difference in generations to understand this work-life balance. Because if you talk to, for example, they are workaholics, and the balance for them is, you know, work is primary. So if you were to say, how do I get balance, work-life balance? Well, if I'm working and I do well there, then I have, you know, the resources that I need to make sure my family's taken care of. And I have, and that makes me feel good from a mental aspect, right? So these are, you know, many of them, you know, put God first. And so that spirituality is in check. So I think that for boomers, you would say work-life balance tends to be more work, but that gives them balance. And I'm guilty, right? I'm a workaholic, but that makes me happy. That makes me feel, you know, fulfilled. Therefore, I am better for my family. I see the fire service also as a family that I need to care for. And so when I am doing that, then that gives me also my fulfillment as well. And I'm a very faith-based person. So, you know, I can check that box as well. I'm not so good with the social stuff. So you had asked, I'll tell you a little funny story. You had asked about going through the process of becoming the fire administrator. Well, when I was doing my background security check, which is a very in-depth process, they would ask me, you know, for references for, you know, friends. And I gave them like six people. And I'm thinking that's, you know, enough. And they come back and say, well, do you have any more friends? And I said, I have friends. I mean, it was almost like I have friends. And I said, I gave you these six. And they said, well, do you have any more? And I said, you know, I have work friends. And they said, no, we need people outside of work. Well, I only have these six. So I started evaluating. I'm going, okay, maybe all my friends are at work because that's where I spend my time. So I don't do so well probably in that social quadrant. So I like the way you divided that up. But I think we're driven primarily in one quadrant or another. And it, again, coming back to generations, if we move to the Xers, which is a smaller group, then the Xers really began to look for that, what you called a work-life balance, right? They want to work, they want to do a good job, but they also want to go home and have a family because they may have been the children of a boomer and they know what it felt like being of a workaholic, right? You didn't have a lot of parent time. And so they adjust in their own lives and they began to have this, I'll work, but I'm not coming in every time you call me for overtime, right? A boomer will. You call overtime, they're on their way. An Xer primarily is going to weigh out what's happening with the family, you know, those sorts of things before they make that decision. And then we move to our millennial group, which are really becoming about three quarters now of the fire service. So there has been, I see as I'm talking, there's been a progression in the fire service based on these generations. And so we have now the millennials who are about three quarters of, you know, are the job. And they know well the life piece. They know well the mental piece. They know well the social piece. They are much more limiting on the, you know, the work piece than we've ever had before. Though they're learning, we've got a good training up as leaders. They are great at decision-making, very quick decision-makers. So they fit in this space. Now that they are developing more of the work ethic and understanding a little more of the balance. So they came in heavy social and had to learn the work side where the boomers were just the opposite of that. So I would say that that's kind of where the fire service is. And we as boomers and Xers, we did not reveal a lot of our mental stresses, right? You kept that to yourself. You kept it inside because you were, you know, appeared as weak, right? If we revealed those things. Well, the millennials have taught us a lot because when you have a whole generation, and the Zeds are going to be even different, even more open, but when you have a whole generation, you know, they're posting things about their whole life on social media, you know, even down to what they eat, then they're going to be much more open about mental issues. And yeah. This is a good thing for the service. It is much more out there. They're much more vocal. You know, I'm not doing well mentally. I'm going to need a moment. I'm going to need some. And they're much more open about that. So I think these changes, as we progress through generations, these changes alone are helping with the fire service becoming much more in those four quadrants, as you say, balanced. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest one of those is our behavior health awareness and really starting to deal with things pre-event. And what I mean by that is, you know, we struggle with suicide in the fire service. That's no secret. But what we do have to do is deal with behavior health up front, because if we can deal with the pre, then we don't have the post event, mm-hmm. right? So these kinds of things that when I talk to fire service leaders, I'm saying, you know, we have got to watch as we, you know, have the mental issues, as we have, you know, struggles, and we don't see mental illness as being, you know, a bad thing. It is the norm. We all have a mental, from time to time, a struggle, whether it's just high stress day, whether it's a, you know, a death in the family, whether it is some stressor that comes to you in your life. For that moment, you've got some mental struggles. And so it's how we build that resilience to come back from those mental struggles, I think, that matters. So I'm going to stop talking because I know you're thinking about something. You know, when I start, I don't stop sometimes, but I do want and have some conversation, Donnie, about resilience and particularly the Zeds that are coming on.
No, and I agree with you. And I recall our episode with Todd, episode 43, if listeners want to follow that. We were joking. You made the joke like the light socket that, you know, when we were kids, we'd stick something in it and see a spark. But then when we became parents, we put plastic plugs in the sockets, right? And but I know what you mean by the resiliency is interesting. I'll tell everyone this short story. So my youngest daughter, she's a senior in high school and running track. And I had both my younger girls run the 400 meters and the 200 meters in track. And I always would tell them, I said, the 400 meter is the hardest race in track. And I'm a former track guy. And I go, it's the hardest race. I go, it's all out. You just, you know, and so she's still trying to find herself, of, you know, what the best strategy and, you know, how to run it and still working it all out. And she came up to me. This was a Friday night, just a few days ago. She came up to me at a meet before she was running. She goes, it's awfully windy. She goes, you know, and she goes, you know, do you have some strategy and words of advice or things like that? And I said, Hannah, you got to find it right here. And I'm pounding my chest for those that can't see. I go, you got to figure it out for yourself. I go, that's my advice, you know, and I was thinking about it. When I got thinking about resiliency, and that's really what I was trying to teach her, is you got to find your own fight. You got to pick yourself up off the ground. I can't help you on that back stretch, the last 100 meters, to just, you know, empty the tank and then find a reserve tank somewhere and just give mm-hmm. it your all. I go, you got to mm-hmm. find that yourself. And I think that has a lot to do with resiliency, is that, I know what, you know, there's a lot of data, and I want you to talk about that, you know, where the Zen generation, yeah, I think you know, is one of those things where it's like the worst thing that could happen to someone in high school or college is they lose their phone, you know?
Yeah.
That's a stressful thing.
And that is a stressful thing. And what we're seeing in this is data from various sources where we see these suicidal tendencies, or we see overwhelming, the term that's used by the younger millennials and into the Zed group is adulting, right? So I had never heard that word before, this generation. And I think it's, you know, it's one of those words that began to describe what they struggle with, is becoming an adult or adulting. And that means everything from a job, right? Mm-hmm. Not just work. Save enough money to go have an adventure, and then you come back, move in with your parents, and, you know, save money again, get a job and save again, right? That is not adulting. That is, you know, still having some levels of immaturity as far as living on your own and being an adult, right? So paying your own bills, doing your own laundry. These are things that often these generations report struggling with. Getting a bad grade in college and going then to negotiate a second chance, right? Continuously. because you think, you know, you should always have a second chance. Well, that's not how college works. And even though we did that, you know, as you said, the thing, putting it in the metrics socket, that's just one example of how we so protected and so, you know, made sure everybody got to play and nobody had any bad experiences or that made them feel bad. Well, when we did that as parents, we thought we were doing the right thing. And yet we really handicapped our children from a mental perspective of resilience, of how to overcome bad things, because we were protecting them from bad things. So they never experienced them. Therefore, they had no way to overcome them because they never had them. And so we have really limited the resilience in a lot of these, you know, as I say, younger millennials into the Z generation, where they are completely overwhelmed with college work. They're overwhelmed with, you know, getting a bad grade and not being able to have that second chance necessarily. And their phone dying, you know, this is a major, you know, their battery on their phone going down and being disconnected even for a moment is reported by these folks as being overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And so how do we then repair some of this that we, you know, as parents, and I'm guilty, are responsible for? Well, we have to teach resilience. So when you don't learn it from having the experiences that cause you to build resilience, and I often use the analogy of a boxer, you know, when a boxer gets knocked down and they're not knocked out, they're just knocked down, their job is to get back up and keep fighting. Well, that's resilience, right? And that's, so when bad things happen, we have to get back up and we keep fighting. You know, you fall off the horse, you get back on and ride again. Mm-hmm. And so these are the kinds of things that are resilience building analogies. And so we have to figure out how do we teach that now to a generation who have been so protected throughout their life. And one of the things that the military has seen, I often go to the military for examples, is that the Army has a program called Ready and Resilient, because they know this is an issue. We have to teach what they didn't learn earlier in life. And so this Ready and Resilient program really helps the soldiers to build resilience and see these threats or challenges as opportunities, right? Not as bad things, but how do I look beyond that moment of what I see as a threat or a challenge and find the opportunity in that? Or in the crisis, in the moment of a crisis, where's the opportunity? And that's resilience. How do I transition my mind from crisis to opportunity? And that is an incredible program that folks can look up. So it's an Army website, Ready and Resilient, but for the people can look that up. But for the fire service, the IAFF adapted that program. So they took the Army Ready and Resilience program and built it for the fire service. And so the IFF has a resilience training program, because that's what it is. It's training how to be resilient. How do you process these god-awful things that we see in the field? And how do we process them normally, right? So that they don't become or into, you know, PTSD situations, because we have cumulative of these bad things through our career, right? And so we need to learn how to process that. So the IFF has taken that and attached it to their peer support. And so their trainers now can learn to become resilience-based trainers, and you can have these this resilience training. And I really encourage everywhere I go, chiefs, as you are hiring right now, anybody under 27 years old, when you bring them on, they are part of a generation that has had very little resilience building in their life. And so you want to make sure, and it can be others on the job. Unfortunately, spans a lot of the millennial generation as well. We need to teach them what they have not learned through their experiences in life, because they are now in a very high risk, high threat. The likelihood of them seeing things on a daily basis that they are going to need to process as reality, not virtual or augmented reality, mm-hmm. which they have grown. Actual reality, and they don't often have the mechanism or the mindset of resilience built in to do that. And so these programs are going to be vital to be part of what you do in recruit training and ongoing training within your departments.
Now, that is excellent information. Yes. And my son, he came out of the 82nd Airborne. He fought 9 months in Afghanistan, and today he's a full-time firefighter just outside of Cincinnati. And I know he's the resiliency, what he left as a boy and came home a man for sure. So very, very proud of him. But something I keep my as eye on though, too, be. Thinking about all the stuff witnessed over there and the cumulative effects. But
how did he process it? Right. You know, it is that processing over. That's the other thing we need to understand, is that sometimes, you know, it doesn't show up again until you have a certain similar circumstance pop up, and then you're able to understand whether or not it was processed normally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That I know. I still learn things. It's been several years since he's been over there, but I still learn things.
Yeah.
Let me transition a little bit and talking about you as you. Talk about family. You have a family.
Oh, wow. Yes, I do. I do. I have a family. So my husband is a firefighter. Surprise. Most folks who know, he recently retired. He was with Fairfax County and retired actually 2 weeks ago. So 31 years on the job. So he did 13 years out on the West Coast and then came to Fairfax County, where he did another 18 here. So he is great. He's been a uniform aide to the chief of department for the last few years, just doing special project management. He led the World Police and Fire Games and also their accreditation for the department. So he has been really, really blessed with some great opportunities himself. So his name is Rich, and he is excited to be retired and for next. So he's not very good at retirement because he went right back into doing projects and things like that with CPSC. So we both sort of failed at retirement, but that's okay. That's, again, we're back to that workaholic thing, right?
Yeah.
And the boys, Gary is out in Seattle area. So he is actually a firefighter, again, surprise, with Puget Sound. So he spent a lot of his last few years working a job, but also trying to get on his dream job, which was to be a firefighter. So he's been on going on 2 years on the job. And then our other son is Jared, and Jared went on the job straight out of college. So he was a firefighter paramedic. He had gone to paramedic school during his undergrad and went on the job, but he only did 4 years on the job and decided, you know what, I want to do something else. So he's a classic millennial. So that sort of, you know, broke my heart. Nobody leaves this job, right? Yet my son did. And so that sort of it broke my heart at first, but He has progressed now. He is a professional bodybuilder and also a nutritionist for other bodybuilders, and also has completed an RN, a bachelor's of RN, and now is just finishing his nurse practitioner school. So he is kind of a school geek like I am, and now progressing on to his career as a nurse practitioner. So still in the service arena, but that's yeah. So they're all over. It's about just a little bit. And we're definitely a firefighter family.
Now that is awesome. Awesome. Well, one of the things, you know, is,
but I didn't tell you I have grandkids. Hold on. I have two grandchildren, William and Marcus, who, of course, don firefighter gear whenever they can. So they're our future. As well. So I did not mean to leave them out at all. So that's the exciting good stuff, right?
That is. That definitely is. Well, let me take you back to perhaps before marriage and before children and all of that. We talk about sort of, everyone has generally some type of guiding principles in life. What are yours and where did they come from?
Oh, wow. That's a big question. I think that my guiding principles really are faith-based So I was raised in a Baptist church down in Tennessee. I grew up in the Nashville area. Very mom. Yeah. And very strong mom. And, you know, was in church every time the doors were open, you know, basically. So I grew up in that environment. That's where I learned a lot of my leadership skills, I think, as well, and how to speak and how to treat people. And I think, you know, given that context, I'm a big advocate for, you know, being kind to people and understanding that as a leader, we have to lead people who often don't have the same value system that we have or have made the same life choices. And that's one of the things I try to teach today is that as professionals, we need to make sure that the people who we lead, because they have a choice, by the way, people have a choice, the kind of leader they want to follow. And when they trust you as a leader, then they make themselves vulnerable to that. And I am very much a don't let anybody down kind of person. And that's really what drives me. And so I don't want to let those who choose to follow something I say or follow, you know, something that I advise or whatever comes out of the science, I really don't want to let them down. And I think that often you do that by recognizing them, by leading as if others' lives depend on it, but by also understanding that even if we lead based on our own life choices, our own values, that there are others that we must lead who don't have those same life choices and values. And yet we need to make sure they are the best, whether it's a firefighter or the best leader of an organization or whatever that they can be. To me, that's leadership, is leading where we can understand and accept and value the differences in people. And so all of that for me boils down to being kind, being academically and intellectually competent at your job. So I'm very driven in those two arenas most of all, competency and being kind.
Oh, very nice. Very, very nice. When you're saying this, it made me think of some things that I'm starting to spend time on, and that is the holistic side of leadership, or leading the whole person, and starting to look at it from an ethical construct, as in that is really the ethical way of leading, is that if we see someone that is severely overweight or obese, not addressing it, is that really the right side of leadership? Or because we know that it leads to preventable diseases, we know it's going to lead to, statistically speaking, greater chance of injury on the job or line of duty death. What are your thoughts on that, from starting to look at leadership, not just are we teaching and training on the fire ground and the execution and all of that, but when it comes to that self-care piece, right, as I talk about, as well as, you know, if we start seeing or feeling, or maybe we should be proactive and taking that inventory list of, hey, how are you doing with your spouse? How are you doing with your children? Hey, you have a son and plays Friday night football in high school. When's the last game you've been to? Yeah, you got to swap shift with someone. You got to make it to the game. You know, what are your thoughts about starting to apply some, looking at it as through the ethical lens of leadership, looking at those areas?
Wow. That's a great question. So I think you're spot on at, you know, the self-care and encouraging others in that arena, encouraging others in seeing things they might not see, or seeing things that they may see and just deny, and say, you know, I'm worth it, so I'll suffer, you know. And I think that helping people understand their own self-worth is important as a leader. And so this is goes back to, you know, what I said about being kind. It's not what you say sometimes, it's how you say it and with what intent. And if your followers understand that you have, because you've built this as a reputation, you have their best interest at heart because you've shown them this before, then they can trust you in what you say to them. When you point out, you know, why don't you go to your kid's game? Or how about we, let's change how we're eating. How about we, you know, let's do this together. What we choose on a day to day, because you know what, you're worth this. Let's do it together. And so these are the kinds of things that leaders can do to really extend themselves. You know, in the fire service, and as I said, I went on the job back in the late 80s, and at that time there wasn't there was kindness, but there wasn't a lot of kindness to new different people coming on the job, right? And so I had the whole scope of, you know, the guys who were great, who wanted to be protective, because they had great respect for their sisters, their daughters, you know, whatever. And so they wanted to make sure I was okay. And then you have those who didn't want you there at all and were complete, you know, asinine, individuals. And, you know, the fire service has a reputation, a really bad reputation, honestly, of not having very psychologically safe workspaces. And sometimes it's not physical safe workspaces, but that really comes from the job. But I'm talking about, you know, psychologically safe workspaces, the way we treat each other. Mm-hmm. And so this is something we have to overcome before we can trust each other to have someone else's best interest at heart. I care about you, therefore, what I'm saying to you, I'm doing it out of my care and concern for you, not because I'm making fun of you, not because I need to cut a slight to make you understand, you know, you're obese and you really need to do something about it. Because over the years, that's been a condescending conversation, frankly, throughout the fire service. And we can't do that if we want behavior change. Belittling someone else is not how you get behavior change. And so we have to understand that we've got to rise above and again, value and for goodness sakes, figure out how to be kind and be a leader who is confident and can truly care and can truly get people to behave differently because you're kind about it, because of how you lead and your consistency in leading. That's the other thing, Donnie, I think that gets lost sometimes is that as leaders, okay, I'm going to be kind in this moment. And then over here, I'm going to be, you know, an ass again. Pardon me, but I shouldn't say that word as, you know, fire administrator, but anyway, you know what I mean, right?
Yes.
So in leaders, we need leaders who are consistent. And I tell chief officers a lot, your people should not have to wonder who is showing up at the station and what kind of mood you're going to be in today. You should have behavior that is so consistent that they look forward to seeing you come to the station, not wondering, you know, okay, what kind of mood is he or she going to be in today? And so these are the kinds of consistent behaviors, I think, from a leader that gets trust and therefore movement toward their own well-being of your followers. Does that make
sense? Oh, absolutely. It makes a lot of sense to me. And I'll share with you something else that I do is that I teach an executive leadership course in the MBA program at the University of Dayton. I've been teaching it for years. I use the same formula that I use for my work-life balance. Understand your current reality as a leader, declare your desired future, and then let's put a plan to get you from point A to point B. One of the things, Lori, that I have found, and it amazes me, and these are all working professionals in their MBA, so they're in a leadership role out there. And one of the things that I always find is that people generally assume others follow the way they liked to have followed a leader. So if they're a big picture thinker, hey, just give me the objective of what you want done and let me take the ball and run with it. That is sort of their default method of leadership, because that's the type of leader they like to work for. And yes. And then, so what I do is I share with them the piece about followership and followership theory, that people follow it on all different levels, just like situational leaders, right? And that's why I love situational leaderships. Like, you know, you need to really understand how this person has a tendency to follow and meet them there. They may not be the big picture person. They may be the, tell me how to do steps 1 through 10 and I'll execute it flawlessly. But if you expect me to guess them, I'm going to fail. You know, and it's always been such an eye opener to the leaders in the class when I share with them about, you know, can you adjust your leadership and meet them at their level? Mm. And instead of being, you know, oh, I'm a macro level thinker, big picture strategy person, giving you the objective, just figure it out. And I'm like, they don't figure it out. Not all of them, right?
Yeah.
But so I love that piece about, you know, the whole followership thing. And I think that's something when we look at leadership, you know, all the studies that we do on leadership, you know, as human beings, right? And in academia, so few on followership. And it's like, that's the other side of the coin.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, but let me, I know we're coming up on time here a little bit. Let me ask you a little bit about, you've said you've been a workaholic. You know, what are your priorities? Let me say, how do you balance things now? Or what are some of your biggest challenges now? You've got to be swamped in this position. So what are some of your challenges today?
I sort of went from the old proverbial, frying pan to the fire. So my workaholic didn't get better. It got worse because of the commitment and the time urgency of this situation. Right. So as a U.S. fire administrator, I have, the time that we have in this current presidential administration, as you know, that can be 3 years, it can be 7 years. We'll see what happens in 2024. But that gives us a bit of a sense of urgency and trying to move some things. And I can tell you that, you know, for many years, the USFA Fire Administration has been really, you know, it become irrelevant, because all of the national fire organizations were really stepping into the space and filling gaps that USFA had really left undone. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very passionate about getting USFA back to its appropriate status, back to being relevant again as the leader of the fire service, and really trying to reestablish some of its capabilities, its functionality, all of those things. And of course, you know, the time during the COVID pandemic did not help any of this. And so we're really working very hard to reestablish a presence, coalescing our fire partners, for example, and really working within the fire service to bring it together, rather than having each of our national organizations sort of on different paths and yet doing the same thing. We need some coordination if we're really going to lift and move the fire service forward. And we really have some real issues right now. So one of the things that I'm trying very hard to fix is our data situation. The NFIRS data situation has not been touched since 1995 in earnest, right? We've had little fixes along the way, but we've got to build a new system. And so we're working very, very methodically on getting that done as quickly as possible. We've got to deal some with the EMS within the fire service, certainly bringing it up to bear within USFA, because we have two people in USFA that are really EMS focused, to speak of when EMS is over 70% of what we do. So why does USFA not have appropriate resources for that? So another thing is the whole WUI situation. So when we talk about climate change and understanding climate change, and yet we watch as the built environment continues to expand in the interface, right? And we're not really translating the science that we know. If you're going to build in that space, there is specific science that applies to the structures you build, the spacing, the landscaping, all of those things, the entrance and exits, you know, the road width, all of those things. And yet we watch many times as these aren't being followed. They're not even recognized as science that can apply to help with the safety in that space. And so USFA has a huge role in that, in translating science into practice, getting it to the fire service so they can be translated down at the local level. And so we're really working very hard in that space. Mm-hmm. The other thing, you know, that we're doing is making sure that we have the WUI resources inside the USFA, because what we see is that forestry and ag and interior, right? They have a lot of resources and they're getting resources for the forestry. That often does not include the interface piece, which are our state and local responders. And so this is a space that we're trying to do some translation and just to bring some recognition to that area. And of course, all of this translates back into data, doesn't it? So, you know, what we train at the National Fire Academy, our efforts in diversity, equity, inclusion, the WUI interface, all of these things really come back down to the data piece. And so we've got to get that right. So these are the things that are, you know, the immediate pieces on our plate. And the final thing that I'll mention is the fatality numbers. Fire fatalities in this country are off the charts. And we think because our data shows that fires are down, fires are not down. And this is another piece of the data that I've been trying to help people understand, is that when, and everywhere I speak, I'll say to the firefighters, and I'll describe this scenario that, you know, you often go into your records management system to complete your infers data, and you will, you know, which boxes to click so another window doesn't open, because that'll mean you got to spend more time entering data, right? So you're very careful about which boxes you click. What that does now is say, oh, that fire wasn't really a fire. So I didn't complete the fire module. So it shows up in the data, it wasn't a fire. And so we have a very underreporting of fires in this country. And yet our fire fatalities, we're watching, we do media scrapes for fire fatalities. These aren't coming out of the data system. We've got people that are assigned just to watch the media. Well, if you've got a fatality that's not reported to the media, then we don't know about that either. So our data right now are not helping our scenario for what is our reality of the fire problem in this country. And so we're working very hard to make sure that we can bring that back to the table.
No, that's very helpful to know. And the data is so helpful when we get good data, right? And then we can use it and mine it. That's for sure. Well, Lori, is there anything that I did not ask you that you were hoping that maybe we would talk about today?
I don't know. You covered a lot that I didn't want to talk about, but I'm just... No, this was great, Donnie. I really thank you for the opportunity just to talk, because it is, I think it's important that people who don't know me know more about what I'm thinking and maybe want to be involved with what we're doing to try to move things at USFA. I'm so honored that President Biden tapped me to do this for whatever time period that we are here. And I'm excited about the opportunities ahead. And it takes things like this for people to understand who I am and maybe be motivated to be involved with some of these efforts. So thank you.
You are very welcome. And speaking of motivation, as your son is a young firefighter, as well as my son is a young firefighter, what advice do you have for all the young ones out there coming from the U.S. Fire Administrator? What advice?
Oh, I love that question. Wear your SCBA, wash your gear, even if nobody else is doing it. These are things that will keep you alive. Be situationally aware, but more importantly, maintain your competency so that you have situational understanding. Yes, I can see smoke, but I need to read smoke, right? I can understand building construction, but I need to understand how the building's gonna come down on me, right? These are situational understandings, right, that go beyond our awareness. Watch human behavior around you. That's another thing right now. We're doing so much EMS and there's so much hate, unfortunately, and so much mental illness within our streets, and watch human behavior around you. Be situationally aware and understanding of those. And first and foremost, be kind. Not only to the people in your stations, the people that you spend a third of your life with minimally, right? But also to those that you are bringing hope to their lives in whatever horrible moment they're having. You may not be able to fix it, but you do bring them hope in that moment. And that matters in your role. It matters to that person. And those are the kinds of things that it's part of what you do. It's part of who you are as a firefighter and a paramedic. And it's life-changing for those that you encounter. So how about that?
Thank you so much for that advice for the young ones out there. Absolutely. And Lori, I have one other little surprise for you, is that I, once in a while, depending on, you know, who I have on as the program, but you got talking about your family, and is your oldest son, is it Gary? Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. Okay. I want to make sure I'm trying to read my writing. Gary. Right? So your husband, Rich, your two sons, Gary and Jared, and then William and Marcus as your grandsons. Podcasts, one thing about the beauty of them, or this is could one day show up on YouTube, right? You know, the video and things like that. But if they happen to stumble across this podcast or this YouTube video, say 10, 20 years, 15 years down the road, I want to give you an opportunity to leave them a message right now. Your family.
Oh, wow. You're going to make me cry now. That's the other thing I do, is that I wear my tear glands are connected to my heart. So I,
well, that's
I cry
okay.
like that.
That's okay.
Oh gosh. Wow. I love you. I am so proud of all of you. I know you're doing good things. Continue to do good things and make a difference in the lives of people you touch. I told you I was going to do this. So
no, that was beautiful.
I will leave it at that.
That was beautiful. So you got to let them know you have a message for them on the podcast.
Yeah, okay. I will.
Yeah. And lastly, I always toss my guest an opportunity. You mentioned faith is a strong suit for you. If you'd like to give the fire service, as well as our friends over on the law enforcement side, a words of encouragement or blessing, however you'd like to do it.
Oh, I love that. I will. It's my daily prayer, honestly, that, God protects them. Every time I speak, I always end my talks with, may God bless and protect you, those in the room, and may God bless and protect those who are serving on the front lines. And I think there is no greater act of service than what our law enforcement and our firefighters and paramedics do every day. And so I am so grateful, and I do pray and ask God to bless them and protect them. So my message is look to the source of your faith, and remember, for me, the big things are faith, family, and friends. And those three things can be sustaining for you, both physically and mentally. So I think for the balance, for me, faith, family, friends, and that's what I wish for all of those who are serving.
Amen. Thank you so much. Dr. Lori Moore Merrill, U.S. Fire Administrator, thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, thank you, Donnie, for having me. This was such a pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Hey, if you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or EMS professional who enjoys this podcast and would like some help with your work-life balance, you need to check out my Get Balanced program. Not sure if you are balanced or not? Join me over at DonnieHutchinson.com and take the quiz. Together, we are going to get you balanced.